Welcome to Soundings, a program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. Major funding for this program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Additional support for this edition of Soundings comes from the Burroughs Wellcome Company, a research-based pharmaceutical company with corporate headquarters and research laboratories in Research Triangle Park, North Carolina.
Well, most of the time at the very beginning, I'm fixed on the literal heart. I'm trying to figure out what kinds of functional physical problems are occurring in this particular man or woman. But the uniting force behind both these hearts are the stories that patients tell us. And so in the course of listening to stories over 25 years of practice of cardiology, I find that there are different admixtures of the literal heart and the metaphorical heart in the practice of medicine, depending on...
But even as the United States moves to provide all citizens with affordable and high-quality health care, rising costs have convinced many Americans that change is inevitable. Available medicine, in other words, doesn't always mean affordable medicine. As the population increases...
The passion and practice of medicine, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Listen now for two physicians. I'll talk first with John Stone, a cardiologist and writer from the Emory University School of Medicine. John Stone will discuss his most recent book, a volume entitled In the Country of Hearts. Following that, commentary about medicine and public policy from James Davis, a former president of the American Medical Association. John Stone is the author of four books of poetry and prose. His most recent collection is entitled In the Country of Hearts. The subtitle is Journeys in the Art of Medicine. In the Country of Hearts is available from Delacorte Press. John Stone, read to me from In the Country of Hearts.
He calls my office late Friday afternoon to say that his heart has been running away with him all day. He's 35 and has had an artificial aortic valve in place for 12 years. Out of curiosity, I ask him to place the mouthpiece of his phone firmly against his chest wall. I listen closely. The clicks of his artificial valve are easy to hear. Lepta, 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 lepta. His heart rate is very rapid, about 180 beats a minute, and grossly irregular. The diagnosis is clear. He has a rhythm disturbance called atrial fibrillation. I tell him that I'll phone in a prescription for him. He's to pick it up on his way home, take three of the tablets, and call me back in an hour or so. It's dark outside when the phone rings, but the news is good. A few minutes ago, abruptly, his heart slowed and the sense of fluttering in his chest vanished. Over the phone, the clicks of his valve are slow and regular. Lipped up, lipped up, lipped up. I've never used the telephone as a kind of long-distance stethoscope before, but the technique worked beautifully. Over the miles between us, he and I are smiling as we say goodnight.
Tell me about The Blue Baby. This is one of the small essays that's in this collection in The Country of Hearts. What about this little guy?
One of the wonderful aspects of my career, it's a very fortunate aspect because I was trained as an adult cardiologist. But when I came to Atlanta, I came courtesy of the Public Health Service, and I was assigned to a clinic which saw children with rheumatic and congenital heart disease. Rheumatic fever was a big problem at that time, less so recently. This is about a little child whose name was William, and I've just encountered a little boy, who had the similar kind of problem, this tetralogy of Fallot, the blue baby problem. And it puts me in mind, having seen this child, Jeremy, in the clinic, puts me in mind of an encounter I had 25 years ago. More than 25 years ago, I flew from Georgia to the Mayo Clinic in the hold of a huge military transport plane, one volunteered by the local Air Force base. A nurse, Alice, flew with me as we ferried a cyanotic, a blue infant, only a few weeks old, who also had tetralogy of Fallot. The child, William, was more seriously ill than Jeremy, much smaller, bluer. Alice and I had rigged up in the vaulted whale's belly of the plane, a bassinet that swung lightly like a cradle from the arching ribs of the hull. The plane was too noisy for much talk, but we could see what was happening. William was fine, only slightly blue, as long as he slept. But when he began to cry, his marginal circulation deteriorated. He then got bluer and bluer until, at times, he actually lost consciousness transiently because of lack of oxygen. Oxygen was being piped into his bassinet, but when he cried, either Alice or I picked him up quickly and shushed him. Twice during our trip, it was necessary to give William a small shot of morphine. The drug worked within a few seconds to calm him and put him gently back to sleep, while his color changed by slow degrees from blue back toward pink in a kind of living litmus test. Both Alice and I were grateful when the plane touched down at dusk on the snowy Minnesota runway and we could turn our passenger over to the staff at Mayo. Within 24 hours, William had had his surgery, a palliative procedure that would allow him a chance to grow in the hope of definitive surgery later. When I last saw him, before he moved to a neighboring state, he was 5 years old, pink, sassy, and growing.
All right, now here's a wonderful story that has a happy ending, but I take it that that's not necessarily typical of what goes on in the practice of cardiology. Would you say, John Stone, that there is a real or a perceived tension between technology and then the arts of medicine? We see so much in the newspapers about miracle cures and miracle machines, and is it when we put our faith in those things?
I think that there are definite tensions. Expectations of the patient in this year, in the 90s, are very high. And physicians have led them to be high. But the fact is, we can't cure everybody. Furthermore, as each new technology comes down the pike, it is always interposed somehow between the doctor and the patient. And there's always a tendency, as one sees another human being, to skip over some of the things that we would ordinarily formally have done. A detailed history, for example. A very important part is the physical examination, the laying on of hands. And sometimes we say, well, we guess, let's say, this patient probably has, well, let's say, mitral valve prolapse, and the patient is sent off then to get an echocardiogram or something technological. I think that sometimes damages the relationship. We need that early contact with one human being encountering another who happens to be sick.
Do you think that medicine deserves what the label that we give it? It is a secular priesthood in our society. It is a form of religion. That must make you feel relatively uneasy when people come to you and say, "Cure me, Dr. Stone."
Yeah. There is a certain frightening aspect to that, and yet at its best, there is a priestly quality to what physicians try to do. It's when the expectations are so high, inappropriately high, that physicians get into trouble. And what that means to me is that we have to educate each other. The patients, you know, the word doctor comes from the Latin docere, which means to teach. Mm-hmm. But as I show in the Country of Hearts, very often it is the patient who's the teacher. The patient is our postgraduate education, really. And so as we listen to each of these stories over the years, physicians have a great possibility of a wondrous continuing medical education on a daily basis. It's one of the things that melds both literature and medicine. But the physician, like the priest, is scheduled every day to hear these wonderful stories. Very human, dramatic stories. And of course, going back to Arthur Conan Doyle and John Keats, actually spent as much time learning medicine as he did writing poetry.
Yeah, yeah. What was the phrase that he used? Potent versus poison. Trying to figure out the relationship between the all these vegetable ingredients that went into the practice of medicine. Then, let me ask you this, John Stone. Let me get personal and yet stay institutional for a moment. Where do your ethics come from? How do you figure out that you're treating a patient ethically? How do you reassure the patient that that's what's happening?
It's one of the most difficult things we do. I happen to run a course or coordinate a course in the sophomore year called Human Values in Medicine. This is done at Emory University School of Medicine. And one of the things that we are at pains to do is in pointing out in the approach to a difficult problem such as care of the dying patient is to have the medical students realize that not everybody feels about this subject as they do. I mean, everybody comes to care of the dying patient with visceral sorts of ingrained, inherited reactions to it. But the most important thing for all physicians is to realize that when they're dealing with different patients, they're dealing with a different set of values and backgrounds. And this is a very pragmatic aspect of ethics, I might add.
It also goes to what you do as dean of admissions in a medical school. I mean, we are looking at enormous demographic shifts or changes in the population of this country. Mm-hmm. And there is something, I think, to be said for, what do you want to call it, ethnic doctoring?
Yes.
Now, you know, recently on this program, a physician pointed out that that's dangerous to talk in terms of black doctors ministering simply to black patients, that they're, that can be construed in some quarters as racist. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that? I mean, what about our cultural awareness when it comes to the practice of medicine?
I think we should pick the best people we can find, but we have to be mindful of the fact that a sizable percentage of the population is black, for example. A growing percentage of the people applying to medical school are Oriental backgrounds. And out of these groups, there are many, many excellent people who deserve to practice medicine. What we have to do is to convince them that medicine is the profession for them. For example, in the blacks, so many people have decided that it's better to go into business. And they're skipping right past the opportunity to go to medical school and getting an MBA. What I feel we have to do is to show them just how flexible the MD degree is, to show what a powerful impact on society an MD degree can have, not just solely in the day-to-day doctoring of a given group of patients, but in the molding of a society.
Let's talk about some of the literary models and precedents that you brought, John Stone, to the writing of your book, In the Country of Hearts. You think about things, to what degree are you conscious of these literary models when you write about the human heart?
Oh, I think I'm conscious of literary models every day. Poets and writers live by writing. They live by remembering such lines.
You think of yourself as a physician or a writer?
Well, there's a point in the book in which I am called in the middle of the night to see a patient across the street who is in the process of dying. His wife comes to the door. And I'm over there. I know he's an elderly man. I know he's had angina. And I ask her to wait out in the hall. And then I have this single one-on-one encounter back in their den. The man is in the process of dying. He's taking his last breaths. I think he's dead. I don't have a stethoscope, so I put my ear on his chest, and just then he takes in his last breath. I stop to tell the wife what's happened. I call the funeral home. I call some neighbors to come in. I have a cup of coffee, even though I don't really want a cup of coffee at that hour of the night. And on my way back across the street, I'm put in mind of a line by Emily Dickinson. There's been a death in the opposite house. It may seem strange for a cardiologist to think of something like that at a time like that, but in fact, writers make a life out of such lines, and so do some cardiologists.
Mm-hmm. I think of Edgar Allan Poe and the Telltale Heart. I think of Carson McCullers, The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. We have hearts everywhere in our literature.
Well, we're preoccupied with hearts because for such a long time, the heart was, as in the case of this metaphorical heart I speak of, the heart was considered to be the seat of the emotions, the soul, as it were.
You think that's true?
My brain tells me it's in charge, but my heart tells me the heart's in charge. But you're right. We ascribe a lot of emotions and locate a lot of emotions, both baleful and direful and difficult, in the heart. We say his heart is filled with hate or love.
Right.
And it's something that, of course, poets have used to their advantage for centuries.
Uh-huh. You've used, John Stone, the expression, the laying on of hands, and again, one of the little essays in your book, In the Country of Hearts, tells the story of a physician. Is it you? Is it a colleague? The first thing you look at is the patient's hands.
Well,
why would you do that if you're a heart doctor?
Well, it's the first thing you encounter. You shake hands with a patient, and you note immediately, as Sherlock Holmes was wont to do, as Arthur Conan Doyle had him do.
Created by a physician.
Right. Arthur Conan Doyle went to the University of Edinburgh and got out and couldn't find any patients, so he started writing, and he created Sherlock Holmes.
That's right.
But we greet each other, sort of these bits of insular protoplasm. We greet each other by extending our hands, and it's our first encounter with each other. So we note whether the skin of the palm is wet or dry or warm or cool.
And what, at this part here, I mean, we're on the radio. I can't point to it, but the heel of the hand, if that's red, that indicates what, liver disease?
Sometimes that's true. Indicates liver disease.
I'm going to pay special attention to hands from now on.
I think that looking, part of the physical exam consists of stopping and looking and listening, right, which are the three things that you do before you come to a railroad track. And it's a warning that applies equally to the practice of medicine. For one thing, the patient deserves to be looked at because there may be these clues that the patient had no idea, or who was reluctant to tell you about them.
Yeah, or wouldn't volunteer.
Too much.
Yeah, right.
Right. For example, if they were drinking too much, they might not tell you, but you might find clues in the form of several skin problems to that increased intake of alcohol on the physical exam. So they deserve this. Moreover, patients feel as though they've gotten a better contact with their doctor when there is laying out of hands. I mentioned in the book that one of my friends, a cancer surgeon, who's mentioned in the last piece in the book, The Wearing of the Green, he says that when he goes in to see a patient every day, he takes that patient's hand. Most frequently, he touches the patient just above the hand at the wrist, he feels the pulse, and he takes that pulse, or even if he's not taking the pulse, he maintains that human contact while he's in the room talking with the patient. What this does, he says, and I believe him, it expands the time or the perception of time that the patient has that the doctor's spending with them.
And doctors typically don't necessarily spend
it's
that much time.
It's much better to do this than to mumble distractedly while flipping through the chart to see what the lab work is.
Yeah.
Right. So I think the laying on of hands is a very important and should be a required part of every contact. Of course, there are obviously some differences in psychiatry, for example. You don't come in contact. Radiology, you don't come in contact physically.
Right.
But I'm talking about the diagnostic one-on-one human encounter that you see in family medicine, pediatrics, internal medicine.
John Stone, your book is In the Country of Hearts. Let's move toward a conclusion. Our conversation has been mainly personal, anecdotal, experiential. Let me ask you to step back a little bit. What do you think, if I were to put it to you this way, the single greatest challenge that you physicians face in the 90s? Is it technical? Is it the art of medicine? What's the combination there?
I would say there are going to be many challenges. They're going to be fiscal. They're going to be societal, political. But I would maintain that the single greatest challenge is keeping the patient at the center of what it is that we do in medicine, whether we're doctors or nurses or technicians or any of the whole enormous army of people who help us in the practice of medicine now.
We're in danger of losing
that
focus?
We're in danger of losing the patient at the focus of this human encounter that is the practice of medicine. And if we can do that, then we will keep technology in its place to assign to it the helping and wondrous and necessary role that we must have. But keep in mind forever that the end-all and be-all of what we're about is this patient.
John Stone is a professor of medicine and community health at the Emory University School of Medicine. His most recent collection is a volume entitled In the Country of Hearts, Journeys in the Art of Medicine. In the Country of Hearts is available from Delacorte Press. You're listening to Soundings, a program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings on the Passion and Practice of Medicine continues. Next, you'll hear commentary from another practicing physician, James Davis of Durham, North Carolina.
James Davis served as president of the American Medical Association from 1988 through 1989. James Davis.
If you're lucky enough to find yourself in the economic category that includes the top 87% of Americans, you get the best health care in the world. If you're in the lower 13%, and there are over 30 million of you, you have little or no access to this exemplary system. But even as the United States moves to provide all citizens with affordable and high-quality health care, rising costs have convinced many Americans that change is inevitable. Available medicine, in other words, doesn't always mean affordable medicine. As the population increases, as the number of our elderly expands, as inflation continues, and as miraculous yet expensive technology becomes commonplace, the pressure for economic reform in health care gains momentum. For instance, many corporations are looking at national health insurance, unthinkable a few years ago, as an undesirable but last resort effort to control costs. Disenchantment, sometimes driven by the wrong reasons, also invites change. Yet critics who express no confidence in the system don't understand the full story because the problems that trouble our healthcare system are far more social than medical. Because the United States is a heterogeneous society, its healthcare system will never compare favorably with countries with homogeneous populations such as Scandinavia and Japan. But the national dialogue about healthcare, as manifest in recent reports from the Pepper Bipartisan Commission, the Social Security Advisory Council, the Department of Health and Human Services, and the American Medical Association's Health Access America, this dialogue signals a broad social and economic consensus about the problems that beset our health care system. This consensus, in turn, prompts me to offer several recommendations. First, to prevent its impending bankruptcy, Medicare must be converted from the present dollar transfer system to a financially sound insurance plan that is solid in actuarial terms. Second, health insurance must be expanded to include mandated employer-based insurance for all employees. Small businesses would find it possible to comply by use of risk pools, tax subsidies and rebates, and a gradual phase-in of requirements. Third, we need to return to community rating in insurance. That is, insuring large numbers of people of varying ages and health conditions under the same policy, thus providing a pooling effect and eliminating the cost of marketing and advertising. Finally, Medicaid must be expanded to include all of our citizens who live at or near the poverty level. Medicaid now reaches only 42% of such people. Those who now fall through the net would enjoy health insurance and would pay according to their means. We should remember that national health systems spring from local customs, traditions, and needs. None is suitable for export. Americans, therefore, won't accept the long wait for treatment and the lack of modern technology you find in many other countries. Indeed, recent polls show that the majority of Americans think we spend too little on health services, and they are willing to pay more for the best care. Nearly 9 out of 10 say the federal deficit should not be reduced through cuts in Medicare. Indeed, Three out of four think Medicare spending should be increased. While it thus appears reasonable to increase a portion of our gross national product spent on health care from the current level of almost 12%, it also seems that we are moving towards the overt rationing of care. The fact that we already have de facto rationing of health care automatically places limits upon what kind of care gets delivered to whom. But Americans continue to insist that such limitations stem from medical rather than economic considerations. Providing scarce services on a risk-to-benefit basis appeals to the American sense of fair play. The United States is a country where anything is possible. If we continue to rely on our collective wisdom, intelligence, innovative spirit, and sense of equity, medical technology and healthcare delivery in the year 2000 can be affordable, better than ever, and available to all of our citizens.
James Davis practices medicine in Durham, North Carolina. In 1988 and 1989, James Davis served as president of the American Medical Association. You're listening to Soundings, a program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings on the Passion and Practice of Medicine is available on cassette. Send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 572. That's program number 572. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. Send $2 for a complete listing of Soundings discussions available on cassettes. And when you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center is eager to hear your comments about Soundings.
You've been listening to Soundings, a program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. Next week, Wayne Pond will talk with Ana Lucia Gazola of the University of Minas Gerais in Brazil and with Roger Bartra of the National Autonomous University of Mexico. Ana Lucia Gazola and Roger Bartra will discuss the literary culture of Latin America and its relation to North American literary scholarship. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Partial support for this edition of Soundings comes from the Burroughs Wellcome Company, a research-based pharmaceutical company with corporate headquarters and research laboratories in Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
The Passion and Practice of Medicine, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Listen for John Stone of Emory University and James Davis, former president of the American Medical Association. John Stone discusses his most recent book, In the Country of Hearts. James Davis offers commentary about medicine and public policy. The Passion and Practice of Medicine, some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center this week on Soundings.